well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking about a very interesting case out of Texas, in particular a very interesting legal filing by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton on behalf of the Director of Public Safety, who is being sued by the Firearms Policy Coalition and three of its members in Texas over the enforcement of a couple of sensitive places there in the state of Texas. First, the prohibition on lawful carry, quote, on the premises of a racetrack, then on the premises of a business that has a permit or license issued under Chapter 25, 28, 32, 69, or 74 of the Alcoholic Beverage Code. The business derives 51% or more of its income from the sale or service of alcoholic beverages for on-premise consumption. In other words, bars and restaurants that serve alcohol. And on the premises where a high school, collegiate, or professional sporting event or interscholastic event is taking place. So what's interesting in this particular case, which is called the Ziegenfuss versus Martin. Freeman Martin is the director and colonel of the Texas Department of Public Safety. So there was a motion for summary judgment, which was filed by the Firearms Policy Coalition, basically saying to the judge, hey, just say we've won, right? And this is common. This is a common filing at this stage that, you know, we don't need to go through the expense of a trial. We don't need to go through all this discovery. Based on the facts that we've laid out, you should rule in our favor. Now, the state of Texas also released its response in its own request for summary judgment this week. And this is, I think, one of the first times that I have seen the following sentence written by the defendants in a lawsuit. Quote, the parties appear to agree on the merits of this case. That's right. There appears to be no dispute over whether or not these sensitive places should be challenged and should go away. The brief authored for the colonel of the Texas State Patrol and the head of the DPS, but authored by the Attorney General's office, says the challenged carry restrictions are not compatible with a law-abiding citizen's right to armed self-defense enshrined in the Second Amendment. So you might think that this request for summary judgment would say, yes, agree with the Firearms Policy Coalition. That's not what it says. No, the AG's brief goes on to say, however, while the parties are not adverse on the merits, the numerous justiciability problems that plague this case prevent the court from reaching them. In other words, reaching a decision on the merits. The laws at issue in this case may one day give way to the Second Amendment's protections, but because the plaintiffs have failed to meet the minimum standards necessary to obtain relief in federal court, today, they argue, their suit must be dismissed. And they basically have two arguments. One, they have a standing argument that I don't think, frankly, is that strong, arguing that the individual plaintiffs must show that they are at harm of being arrested for, you know, violating these laws by carrying one of these sensitive places. Their second argument against standing, essentially in this case, is over redressability. And that's a little bit more interesting. Now, again, I'm not an attorney, but the argument from the AG is that, okay, by suing the director of DPS, let's say that the court grants an injunction halting DPS from enforcing these provisions. The AG says, well, the DPS doesn't have primary responsibility for enforcing carry restrictions. Instead, the bulk of that enforcement is handled by local law enforcement, including county sheriffs and municipal police departments. DPS does not direct or control local level law enforcement agencies, so the plaintiffs sought for relief would do nothing to restrain those local agencies, as remedies operate with respect to specific parties. Accordingly, they write, even if the defendant were enjoined, plaintiffs would still be subject to the statutes and would still face the prospect of arrest and prosecution for carrying in restricted locations. Which I think actually is a decent argument. Now, again, the judge could use this lawsuit as a vehicle to say, Not only is Colonel Martin and the DPS barred from enforcing these statutes, but these statutes are barred from enforcement at any level. The judge could reach that conclusion. It might be broader than what a judge would normally do, but if that is the only way to actually provide for a redress of these violations, there's nothing stopping a federal judge from enjoining the law from being enforced by any agency. So even there, I get what Paxton is saying, what the AG's office is saying, but I don't think that alone should preclude this lawsuit from moving forward. But then we get into the really interesting part of the brief, where the AG's office buttresses the Fire and Policy Coalition's position that these sensitive places are not a part of the national tradition of gun ownership. As the AG's office writes, the challenge provisions do not implicate exclusively modern concerns that would have been unfamiliar to the founding generation. Rather, by restricting carry in places that the state has deemed especially vulnerable, they follow in the tradition of sensitive place regulations that was established in early America. Racetracks, alcoholic establishments, and sporting events existed at the founding, implying that the more nuanced approach used for uniquely modern situations is inapt. Racetracks, they say, are analogous to sports arenas. Horse racing is a type of sporting event that took place in early and mid-19th century America. Thus, founding-era racetracks are both an exact precursor for the locations covered by this statute, as well as an analog for the premises covered by the statute that bars carrying at collegiate or interscholastic sporting events. Since those locations all existed at the founding, the Attorney General's office writes, the court should require a relatively tight fit between the challenge provisions and similar historical regulations to satisfy Bruin's second step, were it to address the merits. In other words, we don't want you to address the merits of this case, but if you do, yeah, these aren't good fits for a historic analog. The brief goes on to say, despite the popularity of horse racing in the founding era, no clear-cut prohibitions of firearm possession on the premises of racetracks from that period has been proved to a court. Instead, those courts have found a tradition of prohibiting carry in racetracks and other, quote, places of amusement that rely on evidence that significantly postdates the founding. The fact that racetracks were common during early America in many states strongly suggests that the absence of contemporaneous carry bans shows that those locations were not viewed as a sensitive place in need of firearm restrictions. They also say little historic legislation exists to support a tradition of carry restrictions in venues where sporting events are held. While the Second Circuit upheld a carry ban that included sports arenas in Antonyuk, it only cited two founding era statutes, neither of which were distinctly similar to the law at issue. Likewise, the AG's office says, no distinctly similar tradition of historic legislation exists to support a carry ban in licensed bars and restaurants that specialize in serving alcohol. Courts that have upheld restrictions on carry in places that serve alcoholic beverages have relied on inopposite regulations. A number of founding era laws prohibit the sale of liquor to active duty militia, but those were presumably intended to encourage military discipline and did not enact a categorical ban on carry in taverns or similar places. Relevant counterparts must impose a, quote, comparable burden on the right of armed self-defense and be comparably justified. Militia regulations, the AG says, are neither. Now, Paxton's office does say conceitedly, a spate of legislation around the time of the 14th Amendment's ratification did directly prohibit carry in places that sold liquor, while others prohibited carry in ballrooms and large social gatherings, and still others prohibited the sale of intoxicating drinks to armed patrons or forbade selling firearms to intoxicated customers. In light of the preponderance of this legislation, cases like Wolford and Antonyuk both upheld carry bans in bars, restaurants, and similar establishments that serve alcohol on site. However, the Texas AG says, although this legislation bears some likeness to the ban on carry in bars and restaurants that serve alcohol in Texas, he says it falls short of a distinct similarity. And, quote, given the lack of suitably analogous predecessor legislation, the defendant, in this case, the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety, speaking through the Texas Attorney General, agrees with the plaintiffs that an American tradition justifying the state's restrictions in these particular cases cannot be identified. Again, that's a pretty extraordinary brief. But as much as I appreciate the Texas AG conceding that there is no real historic basis for these prohibitions, trying to stop this lawsuit from moving forward, which means that these prohibitions will continue to be enforced, not only by DPS, but again, by local law enforcement, that strikes me as constitutionally unsound. Because in essence, what you were saying is, yes, these laws are problematic. In fact, these laws are an infringement on a fundamental civil right. But we don't like this particular vehicle that could be used to strike them down, so keep them in place until the FPC or the Second Amendment Foundation or NRA or Gun Owners of America or some other group gets together and comes up with a better vehicle to challenge these statutes. And in the meantime, again, people's rights are going to be implicated. People's rights will be chilled because these ahistorical statutes will still be in place and still be enforced. And that, to me, is just philosophically untenable. If you are, in fact, trying to preserve the Constitution, preserve the rights that are protected and enshrined within, I don't think you should be looking for an excuse to dismiss this lawsuit when you acknowledge that the laws in question are constitutionally unsound. So, again, I appreciate the Attorney General's office conceding the point that the statutes at question here in Zeigenfuss are defective from a Second Amendment standpoint. But unless the AG, and again the Texas Department of Public Safety, is willing to be proactive in undoing these laws that they admit are unsound, and then all their words to the effect of, yeah, we think FPC is onto something here, really doesn't amount to much, right? So we'll see here what happens with this case moving forward. It is possible that a federal judge could grant FPC's motion for summary judgment. It's possible that the judge could grant the DPS's motion for summary judgment and say, well, yeah, you know, I think there might be something to this idea that these gun control statutes are ahistorical, but you can't challenge them with this lawsuit. And it could be that the judge says to both sides, no, I want to hear more. So summary judgment is not appropriate at this point, but we're going to proceed to trial on the merits. We will keep our eyes open for any more details out of Zeigenfuss. But what a strange development there in the Lone Star State. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a column from the New York Post. Wilding at will, New York's crime reforms let kids sow terror on our streets. You know, I've been talking about this and writing about this for, gosh, at least a year now, if not more, particularly in terms of the number of juvenile offenders in New York State who are committing these smash and grab burglaries of gun stores. They're stealing a car. They're running that car into the storefront of a gun shop. They are rushing inside, grabbing as much stuff as they can, typically getting into a second stolen vehicle to get away. And, you know, in many cases, they're caught. In some cases, they haven't been arrested. But even when they are taken into custody, in many cases, they're just quickly let loose to their guardian, maybe put on a curfew. But it doesn't seem like anything really serious is happening. It doesn't seem like there are a lot of consequences. Well, at the New York Post, Hannah Myers talks about why that is the case. She said in 2018, the statewide raised the age law, largely removed criminal consequences for 16 and 17-year-olds. And since then, any misdemeanors that they commit, and 83% of felonies committed by 16 and 17-year-olds land in family court, including 75% of violent felonies, where the victims of these crimes can't even discover the outcome of the case. She says, worse, in 2022, Governor Kathy Hochul signed Raise the Lower Age, which Myers describes as, quote, an insane statute that made offenders between the ages of 7 and 11 no longer eligible to be charged as juvenile delinquents. Even if an 11-year-old, she says, shoots or stabs another kid in front of his school, anything short of, quote, completed murder, he can't be taken into custody. Cannot even be arrested, much less charged with a crime. So what happens? Meyer says his family gets offered voluntary social services. That's it. Kevin O'Connor, a former NYPD assistant commissioner for youth strategy, says you can't even put him in a police car, even if they fired a gun. There's no criminal recourse anymore. And Meyer says because they're no longer processed, we have no idea how many crimes are committed by kids under the age of 11. But in 2021, before this law gave youths infinite license to ill, there were 150 such arrests in New York State, including 50 for assault. Yeah. And again, even for those in between that, you know, raise the age 16 and 17 and they raise the lower age 11 and 12. So now you're talking about 13, 14, 15 year olds, right? Even for those individuals who technically are not covered by either one of those laws and could end up in juvenile court, the consequences are so few and far between. It's and again, the goal of the juvenile justice system is supposed to be rehabilitation, not incarceration. I get that. But they're not even offering rehabilitative services. When you tell a kid, go back home to your parents, we're releasing you to your guardian, don't get in trouble again. There's no, that's not going to rehabilitate somebody. That's not going to tell somebody, oh man, I was really lucky here and I did something terribly wrong. I got to turn my life around. They're going to think, I got away with this. I can't believe I got away with it. I'm going to do this again at the first given opportunity. And again, as we see these juvenile crimes increase, and it's not just in New York State where we're seeing this. We are seeing this in a lot of places around the country. I would say anecdotally, not empirically, but anecdotally, it feels like we're seeing this more in blue states, but I'm sure we're seeing a rise in some red states too. Again, the way to undo this insanity is simple. We don't necessarily need to be locking 11, 12-year-old kids up for the rest of their lives. We don't even necessarily need to be locking 11, 12-year-old kids up until they're 18, depending on the severity of their crime. But there is a difference between providing some consequences and providing no consequences whatsoever. And when the juvenile justice system provides no consequences, you are going to see more recidivism. You're going to see more juveniles rightfully conclude that they can get away with the crimes that they're committing. And until you take some basic common sense steps to provide accountability and ensure that there are consequences, I don't see why anything would change. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. This from St. Petersburg. This was from a Fox 13 in Tampa Bay, Florida. Homeowner shoots and kills intruder. Police searching for second suspect. This happened on early Wednesday morning. During an apparent home invasion, the St. Petersburg Police Department says that two men entered a home about 2 o'clock Wednesday morning. Homeowner fired shots, hitting one of the suspects, later identified as 20-year-old Marcel James Williams. He passed away at the hospital. Second suspect then ran from the home, according to police. The police department says the home invasion appears to have been targeted. So it was not just a random encounter. But they say no ongoing threat to the public. They also haven't released any further details on the homeowner or the second home invasion suspect. But that first release does indicate that this was a lawful act of self-defense. Could be some underlying charges. We've seen a couple of cases around the country in recent weeks, at least I have, where somebody acted in self-defense, but they got arrested for, you know, gun charges or drug charges, something like that. Don't know if that's going to be the case here. We'll try to keep you up to date, giving you more information as it becomes available. And finally today, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a couple of New York paramedics saved a woman during their anniversary dinner. Yes, as I said, a couple of paramedics who happened to be a couple, Justin and Winota Schindler, were at dinner at a restaurant in Baldwinsville, New York, last Friday night, when they heard somebody yell out that a woman was choking. So the pair, according to Syracuse.com, rushed over to try to help the elderly woman who was choking at Daniela's Steakhouse in the town of Geddes. I said they were in Baldwin, so that's apparently where they work. So they were in a nearby town at the steakhouse. The Schindlers work for the Greater Baldwinsville Ambulance Corps, often in the same ambulance, according to Syracuse.com. Winona Schindler says, as soon as we realized something was going on, we were like, well, let's see what we can do to help. So she knew to clear the area, make sure that somebody had called 911. She asked, was there an artificial defibrillator there on site while her husband began performing first aid, started with the Heimlich maneuver. But after a couple of minutes, she was still choking. She became unconscious at that point. She stopped breathing at that point. So they lowered her to the ground. There was actually an AED in the restaurant. So Winona was able to put that on the woman. Justin began performing CPR for about 4 to 5 minutes. And then there happened to be a restaurant employee who had something called a life vac, which Syracuse.com describes as a choking rescue device. It happened to have one in her car or their car. So ran out, grabbed the life vac, which I guess, you know, you stick down the throat and sucks out whatever it is that you're choking on. So they used the life vac. They were continuing the chest compressions, finally got the woman's airway clear to food. And the woman slowly started regaining consciousness. Winona Schindler said everybody was doing what they could to help and wanted to make sure that the woman was taken care of and that her family was okay. And sounds like by the time an ambulance got there, woman was well on her way to recovery. Charlie Roman, who owns the steakhouse there in Geddes, says the family of the woman who choked are regulars there. And so he was able to get status updates on Sunday. This would be last Sunday. Woman's daughter sent him a photo of her mom in the hospital, said she's doing great, and that they were grateful to everybody who helped. He said it was really scary. He said it was a team effort by everyone, and I think it was handled really professionally. Again, I mean, that's just amazing. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Justin and Winona Schindler, as well as, you know, the staff there at the restaurant, Daniela's Steakhouse in Geddes, New York, who had the presence of mind to, you know, help the Schindlers out there, make sure that that area was cleared, calling 911. And that employee, again, who had this life vac in their car. I mean, honestly, I have known nothing about this, but it sounds like that might be something that they want to have, like, in the restaurant itself going forward. And, you know, AEDs are certainly more common in publicly accessible places than they were even just a couple of years ago. I don't know how well these things work. But if they're pretty effective, then, yeah, that might be a piece of equipment that more restaurants should be using. But regardless, in this particular case, Winona and Justin Schindler in the right place at the right time were able to do the right thing to help out a stranger in need and to celebrate their anniversary, I think, in a highly appropriate location and with a highly appropriate action. So there you go. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, I'll be back on Monday with the news from Massachusetts. I'm heading up there for the 250th anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, as well as the Gun Owners Action League dinner commemorating that event. Just a reminder as well that next week I'll be in Atlanta, Georgia for the NRA's annual meeting. We'll have much more on the ground from Atlanta next week, but stop by and see me at booth 665. And until we talk again, have a great weekend. We'll see you soon. Be well. Be safe. Be free.